Welcome back to Clinician's Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser, and we are in Reno, Nevada this week for the Wild West Vet Show, where we're sitting down with all of the different session speakers to get the inside track on these lectures where we can learn all of the tips and tricks that are being covered throughout the conference and you can put into practice immediately. This conversation, I'm very excited to have. Today's guest is joining us to talk a little bit more about how we deal with some of the patients that we see in practice who may not be quite as excited to see us as we are to see them. Dr. Wailani Sung, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
I think this is always such a popular topic, right? We always want our patients to have a better experience. But before we get into all that, tell me a little bit about your background. Where'd you go to vet school? How'd you get here? Tell me a little bit.
Before I went to vet school, I actually went to graduate school to study animal behavior. So I spent 6 years in graduate school studying animal behavior, learning about dogs and cats and large animals, and then decided, you know what, I still really want to practice veterinary medicine. So I went and signed up again for vet school because, you know, I didn't have enough student loans.
Yeah.
So I have a big passion about helping animals and helping people to understand why their pets behave the way they behave.
Yeah.
And it's not because they're mean, it's not because they're spiteful, it's because they're misunderstood, and there's things that we can do to make them better, and there are things that we can do in the veterinary clinic to make their experience better too.
So tell me this, you started out in animal behavior. When did that come about? Were you interested in veterinary medicine as a child, animal behavior? When did this come about as a passion for you?
Well, I was definitely interested in veterinary medicine as a child, okay. And in high school, we got our first puppy, so excited. Of course, we did everything wrong.
Sure.
Right? We didn't pick up a book. We had no idea. We didn't socialize him. And my dog was horrible.
Yeah.
He's your classic fear aggressive dog, barking and lunging. He's actually very good at the vet, but he was barking and lunging at everyone. And I couldn't deal with it. Yeah. I had to pick up a book and read and figure out, oh my gosh, what is my dog trying to tell me? Oh, this is what he's trying to tell me. He's fearful. He wants people to stay away from him. He wants to be handled a certain way. That ignited my passion to educate myself and to educate other people on how to read body language, how to understand what your dog or cat is trying to tell you. And that carried me to applying to vet school. When I didn't get in, my backup plan was grad school. And after grad school, I said, I still want to be a vet.
Yeah.
I still want to have the maximum impact that I can. And that's when I applied for vet school again.
Okay, and so your veterinary degree is from?
University of Georgia.
Go Bulldogs.
Correct.
And you are now
at the San Francisco SPCA.
That is amazing. And so what the work that you do out there is incredibly important. And it is, you know, one of the number one reasons we see surrenders, right, in dogs and cats is these behavioral issues. And so this must be something that you're just reminded of the importance of on a daily basis.
Correct.
Yeah. And you're here at Wild West Vet Show helping us to implement better practices, better handling, and better conversations, I think, too, with clients when it comes to dealing with these behaviors, especially fear aggression in the veterinary practice, right?
Yeah, it's a difficult conversation to have. You know, when I first started in veterinary medicine, it was, you know, as a role of a veterinary assistant, you know, and gradually getting more experience and doing more technician type of responsibilities, restraining. No one really taught me how to do it. They kind of, hey, this is what you do, and they showed me. And I think I alluded to it in one of my lectures, is that no one really formally taught me. They just kind of showed me, and we did like hands-on job training, and sometimes that was not the best. I certainly have banged dog heads on the table.
Yeah.
Right? Now that I know better, I want to do better, right? And that's why I want to educate people.
And you're right, because it's like so often in the clinic, we learn or we teach by what not to do. Like, hey, I just saw you do this thing, and this is not what you do, but it's already been done, right? Our patient has already experienced it. We've already implemented it. And I guess, you know, as a technician who has come up through the years where it was a matter of let's just get it done, whatever it is, let's just pin them down, get it over with. Seeing this whole profession move into like there is no nail trim in the world that is so important an animal should have to defecate and urinate all over themselves and have that terrible experience. We can do it better. It's amazing. It's a beautiful thing. And I think it's helping to kind of combat some of the depression and burnout that we feel on a daily basis because we're having more positive interactions with our clients. Yeah?
Yes. And, you know, our clients have very high expectations of us, and we know we feel that pressure, but it's really important to when you're uncomfortable in the situation, to really tell it's not because we're uncomfortable. I see how stressed your pet is.
Yeah.
I'm the evil doer here. Yes. Like, I don't want to be the boogeyman.
Right.
I don't want to be the person that makes your animal so stressed he's urinating and defecating or lunging and snapping at me.
Right.
It doesn't make me feel good.
Doesn't make anybody feel good. Exactly. No. And we don't have to do that. So here at Western Vet, your topics are titled Fiery Felines, How to Handle Aggressive Feline Patients. I love that. I always refer to them as spicy kitties. And then we've got It's Okay, Be Nice, Canine Aggression During Veterinary Visits. And so those are the titles of your lectures that you're covering here. And both of these sessions begin with the foundational understanding that the majority of our patients are stressed when they enter the veterinary clinic. This is really stress, right? Not aggression, not lack of socialization necessarily. It's truly stress-based. The days of that's the way it is are gone. And we know we can, like you said, do better by not doing the things that we do to our patients and our clients and basically reduce that stress and causing them harm, right? So this is something that can be implemented pretty much anywhere, general practice, wherever you're at, and there is really no excuse for less than this, right?
Correct. There's definitely no excuse. I mean, the premise for all my presentations is about educating everyone involved. Everybody in the clinic needs to be involved. Our front office staff, our veterinary assistants, technicians, you know, the doctors, we need to be on the same team. Right? So we all have the same goal, which is a better experience for everyone, right? When we have a good experience, we retain that patient. We retain that client in our practice. And you don't understand how grateful these clients are. They will specifically come back to your clinic. They will wait for you. If you're booked out for weeks, they will wait for you. They will spread the word that, oh, you need to see my doctor. And that's really important. And there's definitely, if we see that we are causing fear, anxiety, and stress, we need to take a step back and say, is there a better way of doing this?
Yeah.
Do we have to do this today? And one of the key important points is distinguishing clearly what is a need versus what is a want.
Yeah.
I want to trim your nails. Do we need to trim your nails? No, not today.
Right.
Right. We can trim your nails, maybe not today, but maybe next week or 2 weeks. But let's get some training on board. Let's make it a happy process for your cat or dog. And, you know, let's build up their confidence being here. We're not going to hurt them.
Right. I mean, we might not have to trim them all today. We might be able to trim one today,
correct,
right? And leave
yes.
it at a very good experience.
Yeah. And we need to tell our clients that, you know, the more we do, your dog or cat is getting really stressed. We're going to do one or two today. If you don't mind coming back, you know, next week or a few days later, it's going to be a better process. And while we're doing these, we need to be giving them their kryptonite.
Yeah.
And their kryptonite means their high-value food.
I mean,
I have clients coming in with disgusting things like goat tripe to doggy gelato to ready whip, you know, whipped cream in a can because their dog was so floored by that. They were so enamored by it. They did not care what you were doing to them because they're like, yeah, touch my paws. Oh, you did two nails? Oh, what, can you do more? Because I want more whipped cream or want more goat tripe.
That's exactly right. And I think that's one thing that we have a tendency to forget. Like, it's like whatever I throw in front of you is going to, like, this nasty milk bone. Why aren't you concentrating on this nasty milk bone? And you're holding my foot. This is absolutely terror. There is almost all cases, something out there of high enough value, or else we're going to need to kind of get into medical management. And we're going to talk more about that. But the one thing I think that is such an important emphasis is when we talk about the stress, right? Because the stress from the visit is going to have health impacts on our patients. Like, it's going to manifest in multiple ways. And then also, you know, I feel like we have the likelihood that we're not going to see that patient ever again. We're not going to see that client ever again because it's embarrassing. You know, I know my own mom has a cat that can be somewhat spicy at the clinic. And the first time that happened to her, she said, I was humiliated. The word she used was, I was humiliated at my cat's behavior. And though she was never shamed or ridiculed by the staff, she truly felt like she never wanted to go back again because she was so embarrassed by how her cat acted. And so now she doesn't even want to go back to the vet. So now we have the stress on the client. They're embarrassed or they're upset by the way that their pet acted. And then the pet is stressed. The staff is stressed. But ultimately, we're going to see physical manifestations of this, right? I mean, at the end of the day, besides the emotional factor, we've got physical concerns.
Sure. Right? During that time, you have a spike in blood pressure.
Right.
The heart's beating like crazy, right? We have elevation in cortisol and adrenaline, right? And afterwards, what do we see typically afterwards? They go home and they have GI upset.
Yeah.
They're vomiting, having diarrhea that can last for days, right? And then they're embarrassed to give us a call back because their pet made such a huge fuss at the clinic and they're embarrassed because they feel like, you know, nowadays, our pet is an extension of ourselves, yes. right? It feels like, oh my gosh, they were so horrible. Like, I feel like I'm going to get bad service or I'm going to be labeled as a bad owner. And that's hard to tell the owners, like, you're not a bad person, right? Your pet, we understand why your pet is doing this. It's not because he's being a jerk or being spiteful. He is in fight or flight. He's in fear of his life. So yeah. we need to understand and express empathy
yes.
to the clients and encourage them, call us. We're here to help.
Yeah, because I think about it as a pet owner, and my biggest fear is you're not going to like my pet. You won't like them. And if you don't like them, you don't love them. And if you don't love them, then you're not going to care for them the way I do as a mom. And I'm a veterinary professional, but, you know, I know it's annoying to a lot of veterinary professionals, but they are my fur kids. They are my babies. And so I want them to be well taken care of, but I also want them to be well liked and loved when they come to the vet. And it's very meaningful, right? When the veterinary professionals kiss and love and hug all on your pet. And when you have a pet who maybe you can't have those interactions with, it does feel like a disconnect for the client. And I think that's so difficult. And I love that you say we need to come at it from a point of patience and empathy and help them understand this isn't about who you are as an owner. This isn't about who we are as a clinic. We can come up with this together to make sure your pet has the best experience. I think that kind of mentality will go a long way for clients. And to that point, there's so many different ways that we can decrease the stress in a patient's visit, even before they even get in the room, right? Just from walking in the door of a clinic. So can you elaborate a little bit on some of the environmental aspects that we can, you know, use to help reduce and lower stress within the clinic?
Sure. When we have clients call in, we definitely want to have open-ended questions. We want to ask them about their last experience. We want to be honest and say, hey, you know, how did your last experience go? Do we need to have special accommodations? Meaning, does your dog or cat get stressed when they come in? What can we do to help make it a better experience? So this may mean that instead of the clients walking in with their dog or cat right away, they call us or text us from the car and say, hey, we're here, right?
Yeah.
As soon as you have an empty room, come get us and we'll come right in. Or can we escort them from the side door or
yeah.
the back door? Can they come in a different way? Can we have a room waiting for them? And in some of my lectures, I talk about, can we have the staff waiting in the exam room already versus getting them in and then having them wait? And some of these animals get more and more nervous. And by the time we get in there, they're ready at the boiling point. They're already freaking out. So can we be there right in the room, ready to go right then and there, and then we're done.
You know, I love this pearl that you just gave of, can we ask them ahead of time? Because asking for special accommodations is really difficult. It's difficult if you're asking from yourself as a disabled individual who needs an accommodation, or if you have a difficulty or a difference in your pet ownership and you need some kind of accommodation. I think we have a nature to feel badly, and sometimes we put our pets in a bad situation, hoping it will go differently, hoping it's not like last time. Well, this is a different vet. And we have to help our clients know that, you know, your pet's painting pictures every time this happens or learning this is the go-to behavior. So I really love the idea of with a new patient, and like you said, even on the phone, before they're even in the system, how can we make your visit a little less stressful? Is there any accommodation that you need? I think that's such a meaningful gesture that any clinic could do that honestly is probably going to save time and money in the long run, right? Because
yeah.
you're not finding out afterwards that you now have to deal with the situation. One thing that I think we run into sometimes with general practice situations is with high-stress pets who maybe need to be medicated prior to coming into the vet, but needing that established veterinary patient-client relationship. How do you navigate that, or how do you talk to veterinarians about navigating that first visit when they don't have that relationship to maybe pre-med the patient to come in the very best possible condition, but to have the least stressful visit while establishing that relationship?
So if we don't have an established relationship, you can't prescribe medication,
right?
So the best thing we can do is talk to them about having happy vet visits, you know, happy yappy hour, right? They come in, they get cookies, they come into our clinic, and the first impression for that dog entering into our clinic is, oh my gosh, they come in and it's quiet and they're tossing me, not the milk bones, but the high value treats, right? They're tossing me high value, you know, freeze dried chicken or cooked chicken or mozzarella sticks. Wow, this is awesome. I come in and it's quiet. I get cookies here. The staff, they don't look at me. They don't stare at me. They toss me cookies. I go in the room. I check things out. Low stress And great. How many of those visits does it need?
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes one or two visits for that dog, and sometimes it takes, you know, five or six. But at least every time they come in, it doesn't take a lot of time from the staff's work time, because you can have a room available and just have them come in, and the owner does the homework. They do like 1 or 2 minutes out in the lobby, 1 or 2 minutes on the scale, 1 or 2 minutes in the empty exam room, and then they leave and they say, thank you so much. We'll see you next week, or we'll see you in however many days, right? And the dog goes, wow, that wasn't so bad. I came here and I got cookies, or I got ice cream, or I got yogurt. Wow, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that makes so much sense. Like, create that positive association without having, and we tell that to our clients, I feel like, when they have puppies. Come in as much as you can. Come and visit and just get a cookie or a treat. Who else can we be applying that to? Now, this works great for dogs. What about cats?
Same thing for cats.
Okay.
I have cats that come in that are pretty frozen, and sometimes what they just need to do is they need to come in, let the cat kind of get out of the carrier, or even just open the carrier and have the cat see that, oh, look, they're offering food, whether the cat eats it or not. Like, the first time, I don't expect the cat to eat, but usually by the second time, they're like, oh, we've been here, and nothing bad happened to me last time.
Yeah.
Right? So they build on those positive experiences. That wasn't so bad. That's what we want them to remember. That wasn't so bad.
Okay, I think this is so important, and I love that we're getting that message out to clinics to open that up. One thing, though, I feel like I hear over and over again is we don't have time. We don't have time for low stress. We don't have time for this. We don't have time for that. And you did mention it doesn't take a lot of employee time to just open a door and toss some treats and walk away. And I would argue personally, I think this is actually good operant conditioning for your patients and your staff, because I think they actually do enjoy tossing treats to a fearful pet and seeing them bridge that experience. So I think it is good for the staff. But what do you say to those people who give you the pushback on time?
Well, I mean, how much does it cost, really? You know, break your time into monetary figures, right? And also think about client retention.
Sure.
How much money does it take for you to bring in new clients? How many clients are you losing in those situations, right? It's usually worth your time to retain those clients because you already have an established relationship with them. If you can maintain their trust in you, right, it doesn't take much effort, but a few minutes every time they come in goes a long way. We want to build up that positive experience, because if you lose that client, you lose, you know, X amount of money, right? And how much money does it take for you to bring in a new client? So if you
Absolutely.
Have to break it down into figures like that, sometimes I talk to them about that. But it's also about, like, your mental well-being.
Yes.
Like, the veterinarian, your veterinary technicians, your assistants, you know, front office staff, nobody wants to hear the dog screaming or nor the cat yowling, right? It kind of, you know, makes us feel really bad
that we are
the ones doing that.
Oh, absolutely. And you can tell them, oh, I'm just trying to help you. And it's funny, I've worked with clinics, several clinics, in implementing low stress handling, and you feel the energy in the clinic change. You literally feel the day-to-day energy go from this kind of frustration, this kind of downer feeling of knowing, oh, this nail trim's coming in, this dog comes in regularly, it's always a struggle. I remember one case in particular, we had this beautiful little Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, which I say is the, you know, the official dog of North Carolina. We have so many of them there. But she would come in for nail trims regularly. She had a lot of food allergies, and she hated her nail trims. And it was always a very heavy handling. But, you know, she was owned by an older individual who she really needed her nails short all the time with skin, right? We implemented this within the clinic, and we did frozen green beans for this dog,
right?
Because she had allergies. And she went from a miserable experience, like bi-weekly to every 2 or 3 weeks, to just pulling her mom through the door. We finally started doing the nail trims in the room so her mom could watch her suck these green beans down so fast. We would laugh, we would all smile, and the dog, just like you said, willingly, could you cut some more? Because as long as you're cutting, I'm getting these green beans. And I just remember that as being a really memorable case of just seeing a huge shift. And it wasn't just a shift in the dog, it was a shift in the whole staff, and then it was a shift in mom. Mom saw her dog being really excited to come in, and she's like, I don't know what you guys are doing back there, but she loves coming here now. And I think everyone has these stories of these testaments that go over and over again. So how would the support staff, the people who, you know, maybe don't get to make that this is what we're going toward, where money is a concern or time is a concern, what are some just baseline implement things that you give as advice to say, here's how you can kind of start moving in this right direction?
You know, the easiest thing that I started when I started in general practice is I was a new grad with my can of, you know, spray liver paste. And what I did was I started with basic vaccines. You know, hey, I'm going to squirt some liver paste or use some peanut butter, and I put it on a tongue depressor. I gave it to the owner, and they're like, oh, what's this? I'm like, give it to your dog. So the dog's licking it, and while the dog's licking it, I'm vaccinating. Yeah. And they're like, okay. And they're like, okay, when are you going to do the vaccine? I'm like, I'm done.
They're
like, you're done? Yeah. They were like, wow, he usually cries, or he usually tries to run away, or it takes another person to hold him down, right? You can start off basic with things like that. You can start off by one person, instead of holding the dog down or restraining tightly for nail trims, smearing that peanut butter on the counter or on the wall and letting the dog go to town, and you're just doing one or two nails and reassessing and saying, oh, the dog doesn't even care. I'm gonna do more.
Yeah. Right?
So I had an experience, again, in general practice when I had a 12-week-old pit bull puppy come in, and it took two people to hold the dog, the puppy down, while the third person was clipping the nails. The dog was screaming. I had to intervene and said, let the puppy up.
Yeah.
We let the puppy up. I got my liver paste, spread it on the table. The dog started eating it, and we just needed one person clipping the nails. The dog was so happy to lick. They didn't care. He didn't have to be restrained, but the culture at that time was, you're gonna hold still while we're gonna do this to you, right? And by that experience, I showed them that, hey, you don't need that. You don't need to take that attitude. We should try with the least amount of restraint and see what the animal does. And in that experience, you know, I converted three technicians. They were like,
oh,
you're
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
The technicians who put the clients in the exam room, they knew what my policy was, and they saw how effective that was, and they were doing it with the other doctors.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's how it spread. It spread through my technicians, and then my technicians got the other doctors involved, because they were able to say, oh, I saw Dr. Sung do this. Let's try this. And they're like, oh, look how much easier that was.
Yeah, and you really only have to see it. It doesn't take much to be a believer, right? And it's funny, because you can really increase that human-animal bond. You know, I know whenever we had new patients, we would do cheese with a heart and write the pet's name in the middle.
Oh.
And like, you want to just completely melt a client, write their dog or cat's name in cheese with a heart around it, and they're just think you're the most loving and adoring. And I feel loving and adoring to that pet in that moment, and they're happier, they're eating cheese, it's cute to watch. You know, we all have a positive experience. So, you know, I do think that pretty much everybody has, you know, had some kind that has tried this, has that story and that experience. When we do this in the clinic, what I feel like we get into a lot of times with our clients is labeling. And you do talk a little bit in your lectures about color coding your clients and your patients, and say, don't color code your clients. You can, but definitely maybe your patients. So talk a little bit about this color coding system and how you work it.
So the color coding system is basically evaluating the body language of the dog or the cat, right? Green dogs and cats have loose body language. They're approachable. They're friendly. Yellow animals have more tense body language. They obviously look distressed, panting, trembling, shaking, you know, excessive salivation. They may or may not take treats, or maybe a little bit interested in them, but not fully eat them. And the red ones are very obviously distressed, right? They may be barking, growling, or lunging at us, hissing or swatting at us, crouched down, very tense body language, staring straight at us or looking away, and ready to do fight or flight.
I like that you use the word distressed and not aggressive.
Yes, because, and keep in mind, aggression is distance increasing behavior. It is not them trying to boss us around. It is them telling us, please stop. I don't like this. You're scaring me. Like, I want you to stay away.
Yeah.
Right? That's important. And when I color code them, for me, it's like a baseline. If I have a green patient, I want to do everything in my power to make sure this visit is going to be happy, so he remains a green. If I have a yellow patient, what can I do to make this experience better, so that we're starting to fade more towards green and less away towards red, right?
Yeah.
And if I have a red patient, what can I do to make this visit a little bit better, so they go away saying, that wasn't so bad, right?
Yeah, so I guess what I want to ask you about the color coding system is, one thing that I have found in practice is a couple things. Do we end up falsely complacent with our green dogs? So, like, to be fair, I do work with the ASPCA Field Investigation Response Team, right? And so these color coding systems are very important, because they're dogs we don't know. We're going in and out of cages, and we use this as visual cues, right? This is important in the shelter environment. In the clinic, I know we tend to do these same things, and I think different clinics have all different. We see smiley faces, we see gold stars, we see different kinds of codes. I've seen a couple problems. One, I've seen clients decipher this system and get offended, right, if their pet has been labeled one way or another. Two, I worry sometimes that my staff might get complacent with a green dog and forget that anything green can be red when they decide they want to be right. And how do we reassess our reds and yellows when they become green that we're not always constantly coming at them that way? I sometimes wonder if we're not judging them before we get in the room in these cases in general practice. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that if we're going to be labeling our patients, right, we need to be doing it discreetly so the owners can't look at the record and be like, oh my gosh, my dog is red, and get upset, right?
Sure.
And most often, they know their dog is red.
Yeah.
Right? It's not news to them. Secondarily, remember, behavior is fluid,
sure.
right? Every time I go in a room, I go in with the attitude that I might be dealing with a red animal.
Yes.
Right? So that means I go in, I take a step back, I assess, right? I start tossing treats because those are, for me, part of my assessment. If the dog takes a treat, if the cat takes a treat, I know I'm good to go to the next level, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, then I start with body language. I read their body language. I start intervening or approaching them with lower stress techniques, right? Sideways approaching. If I reach out a hand, it's going to be reaching out under. How does a dog or how does a cat respond to that?
Right? Yeah.
So every time I go in, I always automatically assume the animals are red until I see the body language, see how the animal's willing to interact with me, see how willing it is to take food before I proceed further.
So basically, color coding is part of the client history, right? It tells us what's gone on in the past, but it has no reflection of what today is going to necessarily be
like. Yeah, you're never wrong to start off being cautious and then proceed, oh yeah, that animal's taking treats. Oh, today he's not a green today for whatever reason that's going on, and maybe how he's feeling. It may be because he's limping on his paw and he's not feeling green. He's yellow.
So out of curiosity, talk to me a little bit about how you help your staff and your team when they have experiences that are maybe harder to come back from, right? Because we know that there are encounters that can be scary and bites happen or distress behaviors happen. How do you keep team resiliency up in these types of situations?
So it would be great if there's any possibility in your clinic of having a camera set up to record behavior.
Yeah.
So, I mean, especially if you know there potentially could be a yellow or red patient coming into the clinic, is there a possibility of recording it? And just for like staff training, right? When we have a bad experience, we're going to sit down, we can review those and say, okay, what happened? And we can look at, we're not trying to place blame on people, right? But how can we make things better? What can we do different next time, right? Everybody needs a break, and it's not that they did something wrong. And sometimes, you know, even being a veterinary behaviorist, I get bitten too,
sure.
right? And I know what I'm doing, but sometimes behavior changes so quickly that you can't respond quickly enough to avoid that. So it's a matter of, okay, what did I do wrong? Oh, I should have known better.
You can see it, right? When you go back, you see what you missed.
And in the heat of the moment, I freeze and I know, uh-oh, I know it's coming because I knew I either went too far or I saw the change in that dog's face. And I know I couldn't get out of the way in time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That makes, you know, it's absolutely, it makes a lot of sense. And I think you make a good point about reading that body language, taking your time. But I love the idea of going back and being able to revisit and reassess those situations to see where we can learn. Anytime you hear out of nowhere, you know it was never out of nowhere.
There's always a trigger. And if, you know, if you don't have the resources to buy a camera, you don't have to have a camera. You can sit down and recount the situation. You can also look at videos of dog and cat behavior, right? And look at, oh, what does a green cat look like? What does a yellow dog look like? And kind of go, okay, what was this dog doing? Did it look like this? Did he look like that? And kind of, you know, review that and make sure everyone is knowledgeable and remember the body language.
Okay, right? So to that point, what do you love for staff training and veterinary training? What do you love to get people the most educated about these practices?
So the two resources I like to refer people to is, you know, the Fear Free Handling. Definitely, that's a good resource. Sophia Yin's, Dr. Sophia Yin's Low Stress Handling. She has really good videos. Fear Free has really good videos. There's certification levels that you can work through and accomplish. So that helps you get more confident. If you want to do things on your own, definitely go and watch videos of dog and cat behavior. There's many available out there that are submitted by positive reinforcement trainers. Yeah. That's really important.
Yeah, you know, I love to sometimes just sit at a dog park and watch, and they're hard to watch, right? They're stressful and you want to intervene. But I always tell people, if you really want to learn about dog body language, you get some foundational knowledge and you want to apply it, go to a dog park and watch them shake each other off and watch how the dogs interact with each other, and you can really see it executed live and in person. And when you start to know those, you know, I think about even just like teaching my husband that a lip lick is a nervous signal. You know, we have Chiweenies, and so there is constant lip licking and a nervousness in a house that nothing bad has ever happened in. Sure. And he regularly recognizes just that lip licking behavior. Why are you nervous? He'll ask them. And that makes my heart happy, because just one little bit of knowledge has made him more aware. It's something we can do with all of our clients, even on a visit, just one little knowledge drop. See how he did this here. You know, this shifting eye contact. I think all of us in the veterinary industry watch these videos that get posted on the internet. We all cringe and we're all like, oh gosh, this is so hard to watch because the dog is giving all the signals of being uncomfortable. Once you learn those signals, boy, they're loud as train horns, aren't they?
Yeah, you can't go back. Once you know, you want to intervene and you want to say something. But it's also important to educate the owners too, because you don't know how meaningful it is to owners when you go, oh my gosh, did you see that today? He took a treat out of my hand. And they're like, he took a treat out of your hand. And you were like, yeah, we're celebrating. We're screaming, yay. He's so exciting.
Yeah.
Like the owners get really into it. They get so invested in their pets, right? And they get so invested in your clinic.
Yeah.
Like they understand us. They're willing to work with us.
Yeah.
And it's so important.
That is an amazing thing. You know, I think it is a really beautiful thing to see. One thing I kind of want to get your feelings on, especially when we talk about low stress handling, is taking the clients and the patients in the back, right? So this is a long time. It's like, we're going to take them in the back. Your pet is going to be more defensive in front of you. Like, tell me a little bit about the realities there. Should we be taking them in the back? Should we be doing in the room? What are we doing?
I think it really depends on the situation. It depends on the owner. I have some owners who are like, take the dog in the back, take the cat in the back.
It, yeah.
I don't want to see it. Like, it makes them nervous, right?
Sure.
And I do agree, if you have a nervous owner and the dog's looking at the owner and feeding off their body language, that it can definitely make the situation worse, right?
Yeah.
When I ever did that in general practice, I would tell the owner, okay, I'm going to take your dog to the back. And some of the reasons I tell them is that, you know, he's maybe being defensive that you're here, right? And sometimes if he is associating this with a negative experience, I don't want him to associate you with this negative
right.
experience. So I take the animal back. Now, taking the animal back doesn't mean that we can be heavy-handed, right?
Sure.
I still have that food in front of them, right? Yeah. And when I come back, I tell the owner the report. I said, oh, wow, you know, we thought he was gonna get really bad back there. He actually didn't. He took food, he was so excited. And the owner's like, oh yeah, well, you didn't have to use a muzzle. And they're like, you didn't?
Yeah.
Like, they always have to put the muzzle on him. I'm like, well, we didn't. We smeared the peanut butter on the counter and he was licking at it while we were doing the vaccination or getting blood, and they're like amazed at that.
It's so important to work with the patient in front of you, right?
Correct. It's important to work with the patient in front of you, but it's also important to say, you know, is the owner contributing
sure.
or is the owner making things worse,
yeah.
right? And the hard thing too is I also want people to realize, if we take the animal to the back, and the animal is easier to work with because he is frozen
yeah.
and not eating food, that is not a happy experience, right? So what you're doing is, right now the dog is or cat is shut down. So yeah, you can do whatever you want, and it seems like the dog or cat is having a good time.
We flooded them.
They have learned helplessness.
Yeah.
In this situation, nothing. It's hopeless. Nothing I do will help, right? That's not good mental health either.
Yeah.
So we need to realize that. And maybe for those patients, it's better to work with them in the room with their, you know, owner present to help give them confidence, to help keep them calmer.
I'm so glad you brought that up, that we can actually go past operant behaviors and participatory behaviors into non-resistant shutdown that is not any better than flailing and biting and resisting. I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, and so along those same lines of, you know, we know that there's time, we know that we can make this happen, we can find a way to implement it within the practice. What about my folks in emergency? Those guys are always raising their hands saying, like, look, I'm over here saving lives. I don't have time to make it a positive experience. How are you coaching your emergency clinics?
So, again, the same thing applies that I talk about in my lecture. It's coming into the practice. What is the culture? And usually, I've done emergency, so I understand what you're talking about. Coming in, people are frantic, they're stressed, right? It's getting a triage on that animal right away, it's putting them in a room right away. If we need to get that patient away, we need to have a team that one person or two gets the patient away and the other needs to sit and talk to the owner about what are we doing, right? And if we have a fractious animal, how are we going to handle that?
Right.
Can we put a muzzle on this animal, right? So we put the muzzle on this animal. Can we utilize, so for really fractious patients, we definitely need to talk about, can we use injectable sedation, right? We can use that oral medetomidine gel in the oral mucosa. And sometimes that's really helpful. It's just taking the edge off.
Yeah.
So you can do the next step of putting the catheter in them or even putting the muzzle on them, right? Without them flailing and freaking out. There are things that we can do in the emergency situation that can make things a little bit better. Things like using a calming cap or even using those Elizabethan collars can be really helpful, right? If we kind of limit their visual access, sometimes coming in, they're stressed already, seeing all these people, bright lights, people moving fast, loud noises.
Mom and dad are upset.
Yeah, everything adds to that stress level. What are the little things we can do that decreases that level of stress?
So bottom line, it might not be perfect, but we can absolutely make it better. And we can just be creative. If we are anything in the veterinary industry, it is creative. So especially, I'm going to give it up to us technicians and say, if you're not sure, find a technician who's passionate. They will find a low-stress, better way.
Yeah, we cannot do without our technicians.
Thank you for saying that. I love it.
Plum's Veterinary Drugs is the must-have veterinary drug resource. With Plum's Veterinary Drugs, your number one source for drug information can always be right at your fingertips. On your phone, your tablet, or your desktop, wherever you need it. To learn more and subscribe, visit plumsveterinarydrugs.com.
It kind of brings me to my keep it brief segment. I want to talk to you about this all day, but I have to end somewhere, and I come down to the keep it brief. No pressure. We rarely ever keep it brief, so you just tell me whatever is on your mind. But I want to ask you a little bit about the damage control. So we did talk a little bit about how you kind of, we've touched on it a little bit, but when a bite does happen, and a bite happens in the room, and it happens in the moment, what does damage control look like in that moment? How do you get that client to not feel terrible about what happened? How do you take this negative situation that's just occurred and turn it positive? What do you do for damage control when the worst happens and you're going to have to deal with it?
Okay, when that happens, like, we back off, right? We didn't read the situation or the animal correctly, right? Obviously, we did not have adequate safety measures in place, right? So we need to take a step back and say, okay, we're not going to do anything today. You can sit here for a few minutes. I want everybody to calm down. We'll come back in, or we'll stay in the room. We'll start tossing the dog treats or the cat. We're going to do hands off and see if it will take treats. And we're going to talk about what our next step is. So we're going to send this owner home with some homework.
Yeah. Okay?
We're going to either talk about what they can do at home to make the situation better, things like basket muzzle training for the dog, being learning how to be covered with a towel with a cat and not being stressed out by that. And then we also have a plan in place. You know, what happens when you come back in next time? We're going to have happy pet visits. And then we're also going to implement the use of anxiolytics.
Yeah.
Right? We're going to start with oral anxiolytics first, right? And then we also clearly need to define, again, what is a need versus what is a want, right? What do we want to get done? What is needed to be done? And if something is desperately, direly needed, then we definitely need to talk to the owner about maybe the next step is injectable sedation.
But thank you for all your time today. Thank you for coming all the way out here to Reno and having this conversation, helping people do a better job in practice. And thanks so much for being on our podcast today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed being here.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.